I wanted to talk about the issue of ecumenism. I've called this the church and the churches. I myself have some responsibilities for ecumenical work in the ELCA, and that's one of the reasons that I thought this would be a good one to talk about, partly because the assignment came to me when I didn't personally have sort of any settled expectations or commitments on this. In my years in the parish, I was in the parish in 1980 was the particular, it started in 79, and in 80, this was the 450th anniversary of the presentation of the Augsburg Confession, which is the chief confessional document of the Lutheran movement. And that, I don't know whether you remember that, for some of you, that's quite a while back, but that was the year they made a big point of calling it Reformation Reconciliation Sunday. And that in the New England Synod, and I suspect in a number of synods across the country, we were encouraged and indeed aided and abetted by a number of our Roman Catholic brothers in the priesthood in having a number of events, studies, or whatever that brought us together, in particular recognition of this anniversary. So I had that little taste. I served in a parish in Connecticut, and the area was largely Roman Catholic. Lutherans are a fairly rare breed in New England. It has been quite a dramatic change for me to be in the Midwest now, where you never have to explain to anybody what a Lutheran is. But I did that quite a bit in New England. And then in the years in graduate school, of course, in a divinity school with the university, it's non-denominational. So your work is with people from all sorts of traditions. In fact, in many cases, with people who have no particular faith commitment at all. I mean, they're interested in religion. So that's another kind of ecumenism and an important way to study and think about these questions. And then once I began teaching at Luther, I was asked by the Lutheran World Federation, as you know, that this is even the debate about what it is. It has defined itself as a communion of churches. At one point, it was a voluntary fellowship. I don't think there's, to me, a dramatic difference, but what was important, particularly for sister churches in the third world, was the sense that as a body joined together, we share in all things, including indeed the bearing of the cross, and we, so that the things that come, it's not like saying, well, I'm a voluntary fellow in this up until this point and not beyond, but rather a clear proclamation of that kind of solidarity and long-lasting connection. But when you're involved in ecumenical dialogue, of course, the Lutheran World Federation is not like the Vatican. I mean, it is not like they can decree what doctrine will be, what someone will have to do. So it's kind of, for a lot of our dialogue partners, it's kind of an anomaly, you know, who speaks for whom in this. But it represents a group of, I believe it's 130-plus churches worldwide. And when it comes to international activities, they often then will be the spokesperson for Lutherans and try to gather representatives from varieties. So I was asked to be on the international dialogue between Lutherans and the Eastern Orthodox, which is an extraordinary one indeed. So my own thinking and concerns about ecumenism have grown considerably from that experience. And as you may or may not be aware, in the defining documents of the ELCA, a direct commitment to ecumenism is much clearer. We, in the last year, have been given statements. It's a vision and expectation statement for pastoral standards and behavior. And there's a very clear piece in there about the responsibilities of a pastor as an ecumenical leader within his or her own community. And I graduated from seminary in 1979, and I must say, I mean, that's not all that long ago, and I don't remember nearly as much commitment and concern about these questions for our understanding as individual Christians, as leaders in the church, and as a body. So that's what I'd sort of like to take up today. Where has that come from, and what does that mean for us? I was just reading a book review the other day, a Lutheran who teaches at Yale, who's written, his name is Yaroslav Pelikan, has written a 5-volume history of Christian doctrine. It is an extraordinary undertaking. I mean, to have, you know, just and including Eastern doctrine. And as they said, one of the things that singles it out is that Eastern Orthodox Christians have commended him as being the first Westerner to have written something that gets the point, you know, that understands them. Then he began outlining this work as a young man in the 40s, in the 50s, and the 5th volume has just, it's out now and is being reviewed. And what struck me about this very favorable review is something to talk about the change, what it means now to talk about doctrine. The reviewer says that one of the problems that the author, Yaroslav Pelikan, acknowledges is he didn't quite know where to end. You know, what should be the cutoff point in the modern period? And that after originally entertaining the idea of finishing with the formation of the World Council of Churches in 1948, or with the definition of the dogma of the Assumption of Mary in 1950, the event of the Second Vatican Council in 1962-65 overtook his publication schedule. They see, that's so funny. You think you outline a book in 1940. Well, holy mackerel, you really wouldn't have been counting on that happening. You wouldn't have even been counting on it happening if you were Roman Catholic in the 1940s. So he thus decided to conclude the volume and his work as a whole with the council. Given the 1989 publication of the final volume, so you see you have almost a quarter of a century's gap between when he's finished and when it comes out, my only regret, this is the reviewer, is that Pelikan was unable to extend the terminus ad quem of his study beyond the closing of Vatican II to, say, the 500th anniversary of Luther's birth in 1983, or even to the 450th anniversary of the Augsburg Confession in 1980. This would have enabled him to take into account the most remarkable stimuli to the development of Christian doctrine in the 20th century, excepting only the early doctrinal work of the World Council and Vatican II itself. Now, he doesn't mean that the most remarkable stimuli is Lutheranism. What he means is that these two events were actually ecumenical events. If you look at the material that came out celebrating Martin Luther's birthday, all sorts of people wrote about him and examined his importance. You know, what is his importance to the Roman Catholic Church? I mean, that question was asked and answered. So he's saying something has changed, dramatically changed. It wasn't an in-house party exclusively. I refer to the multitude of national and international ecumenical theological dialogues between and among the churches since 1965 that have transformed the way a growing chorus of Christian theologians who are men and women of the church are looking at doctrines that for a long time were regarded as church dividing. By virtue of fresh biblical and historical scholarship, by means of new theological formulations that are able to express the concerns of each side of traditional doctrinal debates, and above all, by setting aside polemics in favor of the principle in all things charity, Christians are now closer to confessing the faith together on such matters as baptism, Eucharist, ordained ministry, justification, papal primacy, teaching authority, and infallibility than at any time since the Reformation. The agreed statements on all these doctrines, plus the scholarly materials often published with them, might well have provided Professor Pelikan with resources for enhancing his treatment of those questions. And as he points out, this 5-volume work is one of the things that, frankly, your grandchildren will probably read if they're I mean, it's going to last. It's going to be for this century. And, the reviewer is Harry McSorley, who's at the University of Toronto. And McSorley is himself a Roman Catholic Luther scholar, you know. So I think, and his hope and expectation is that in succeeding revisions, this is precisely the direction it will take. So I think this is only one example of a number of people who say we live in an extraordinary new era in Christian history with the inauguration of a kind of vital ecumenism that has suffered some setbacks but doesn't appear to be defeatable. And it has caused us as Lutherans to review our history, particularly, I mean, the Reformation period. It's funny, dealing with the Eastern Orthodox, let me say that the Orthodox, when you talk about the big division, will look at you and say, wrong one. It is not for them the division of the Reformation, but the separation of Eastern and Latin or Western Christianity, which formally occurs in the 11th century but was a brewing for a long time. Nonetheless, we are major contributors, in some sense, to the rending of the fabric of the church, in the sense of its unity, and therefore our reviewing our history and reflecting again on what are the present temptations to, shall we say, sustain separation beyond where it makes sense or serves any purpose. One of the interesting things to me is that the Lutheran World Federation founded an ecumenical institute in Strasbourg, France, which celebrated its 25th anniversary last year. And what made it possible was precisely the opening that came in the wake of Vatican II. It dates back to 1965. So that the sense of, I mean, it's pretty hard to be ecumenical without partners. And that suddenly we had partners that we had not had for a long time. Undoubtedly, the historical impetus towards ecumenism has really come from evangelism, from missionary work. And one finds that the first meetings around that those who worked in the mission field, and in some sense had to explain or justify the divisions to those who were hearing the gospel for the first time, realized that they had a greater accounting to do and really were more dependent on working with one another and coming to understandings to advance their work. So that evangelism and ecumenism in some ways are linked very early on. And to be healthy, need to remain so. You know, that you need to be doing both. I was struck, because I'm involved with one of these dialogues, I was invited to a sort of a group strategy mission at the Ecumenical Institute last summer. And there are people from all over the world. And I was very intrigued, as people who've been at this for a while, particularly talking about issues in kind of Western European terms and the way they've gone about this. And there was a bishop there from South Africa. And he said, "I must admit that for my people, the most critical event is certainly not the Reformation." He said, "For us, the historic event that stands out is the arrival of the first Christian missionaries in our country." He said, "I often have the feelings that we are sort of black warriors in a battle that really isn't our own, and very rarely do we understand." He said, "I would be quite happy is that when you have settled it, you would let us know and we could get on." And I think that it's just like looking at one of those maps, you know, where they turn the world upside down so that what you see at the top is not North America, that was a very helpful reminder to us that whatever is taught, what they're doing there, they really don't want to rehash the whole of the Reformation, but they are still the inheritors of its legacy for good and for ill. So that the expanding of the conversation has also forced, I think, a number of us to think again about what's most important. You know, what is really defining of us, and what can become divisive in ways that are unhealthy. So let me say a little bit something then. How is Lutheranism to be understood in the midst of this? The Lutheran movement itself, and even that, how do we think of ourselves? Are we a movement? Are we a denomination? Are we a separate church? How did the Lutherans think of themselves at the beginning? First of all, they didn't like to be called Lutherans. In Germany, they were called evangelicals. From the word for the gospel, being called Lutheran was, of course, a bit of an insult, but it stuck, and we don't see it as a term of opprobrium anymore. But that the understanding, at least in the early stages, Luther himself, remember, was an ordained priest. He was under vows as a member of a religious order. And he was a called and appointed teacher of the church. Luther, at many points in his career, will say, "Listen, you have given me a charge which I must fulfill. I am a teacher of the church. And the fact that you don't like what I'm saying doesn't mean that I can be silenced. I cannot in good conscience do that." But that his self-understanding, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, he decided, "Boy, what I'd really like to do is be a reformer." I mean, there are ways when it happened by default. Historical circumstances worked that he got feistier. And heaven knows he certainly had the personality to thrive on the task that was thrust upon him. I mean, he loved polemical theology. He was very good at it. But he still understood himself as speaking within the body of the church and calling it back to what he understood to be the true Catholic faith. Right? That the church had gone awry. It wasn't something new. If you read the Augsburg Confession, which is not of his authorship, it was actually the work of his colleague and friend Philip Melanchthon. But Luther, there are probably places where he would have been feistier, but proclaimed himself in his letters pleased with this piece. It does indeed reflect a very irenic temperament, that Melanchthon didn't write a document to represent the views of the evangelical party in ways that would have made it impossible for any understanding. Rather, he was very eager to emphasize kind of the points where they agreed. And in fact, when one reads it, and they say, this is what's taught among us, there's, as one of my seminary professors put it, there's always this kind of fetching undercurrent about, like, well, this is the Catholic faith, right? I mean, that's what you believe, right? So that people would find themselves, that their opponents would find themselves in it. Indeed, Melanchthon's first hope when he went to Augsburg and that of those who worked with him was that rather than getting what, maybe I don't know all of you know the circumstances, the emperor of the German Empire had summoned them to the Diet. He was eager to bring about a settlement of the religious differences, and the evangelical party was charged to give some account of what they had been doing. Charles V, who was the emperor, was the lord of extensive territories. By birth, he inherited the lowlands, and as well as coming into Spain. So he had spent almost a decade outside of Germany. And while the cat was away, the mice did play. And so now he was facing an enemy to the east. The Turkish armies had come all the way to the gates of Vienna in 1529. So he wanted to essentially establish religious concord so that he could have a united country behind him, expecting to have to go to war, and not wanting, as you can imagine, the thought that the Protestants might cut a separate deal with the Turk if they were offered better terms. He's coming, but he is himself a devout Roman Catholic and not prone, as a family, the Habsburg family had always been staunch Catholic, and he was not expecting to give place to heresy. So how open he was to an examination of these issues, I suppose, is always up for grabs. But the confession was presented, and the hope was originally to talk about the reforms they had made, what practices in piety and worship they had initiated. And within the Catholic community, within the church at large, there was much criticism of the kinds of things that were going on. So those changes would have had echoes, positive echoes, for many Roman Catholics, you know, that there were abuses in the church. But because of the polemical atmosphere, and one of their opponents had published a document, 404 articles against the Wittenberg theology, essentially lumping what Lutherans did with all sorts of other people, they were then obliged to divide the confession into two parts. And the first part is really doctrinal. They have to talk about what they teach. And that was touchier ground. But its hope clearly was to get a hearing. And ideally, I suppose, they would have liked to have convinced the other party to see and do it their way. But at the very most, they wanted the freedom to continue to proclaim the gospel as they understood it truly. So, at least when I was in seminary, it was interesting to me that Eric Gritsch and Robert Jensen, who at that time were both at Gettysburg, Gritsch is a Reformation historian, Jensen is a systematic theologian. They have written a book on the Lutheran Confessions, which now is about a decade old, but very interesting presentation to look at it indeed as a movement, that Lutheranism was a movement within the Church Catholic, with certain theological insights and commitments, and that the task of that movement was indeed to keep sort of proclaiming its message, its understanding of the gospel, until it was heard. So that its primary audience indeed is the breadth of their family in Christ at that time, indeed the Roman Catholic Church. Now, in the years after 1530, I mean, even beginning before then, but certainly with no backing up in the years afterwards, the Reformation movement moves and moves and moves until you don't just have one sort of dissenting group within a large body of Catholic Christendom, but you have many separated bodies. And the later documents in the Lutheran confessional writings, particularly the Formula of Concord, show that divisions among Lutherans, tensions between Lutherans and the followers of Calvin and Zwingli, everybody against the Anabaptists, and it becomes a lot harder to understand who we are. Throughout, even though in 1530 at the Diet of Augsburg, the emperor was not convinced, nonetheless, it did not actually come to war until after Luther's death in 1546. And in the intervening period, indeed, repeated attempts were made within the empire to reach some kind of accommodation, some kind of understanding, so that Catholic and Lutheran representatives, as well as representatives from the Reformed tradition, came together numerous times. It was the statement of many that they had never been as close as they were at Augsburg. They never were able to settle into something, but the impulse was there, and I think that's a part of the history we need to hold on to. Nonetheless, the other side of it is that historic circumstances, as well as changing, I suppose, ecclesiological convictions, mean that eventually you have separated bodies that now have an investment in sustaining themselves as independent. I was reading an interesting article the other day on the religious wars and toleration in France, which is a fascinating, again, a place where there were Protestants and a large Roman Catholic majority and a great deal more of immediate and repeated war around this, but that there's a real distinction between the concepts of toleration or tolerance and conquered. And that what you found is even as when measures of toleration were granted, meaning, all right, we'll abide with you, you know, we'll agree to disagree. It was more or less for the time being. It was the best you could do. But the real goal was conquered, that somehow or other you would bring or force people back into one understanding or one faith, that they would recognize one another. You wouldn't have these tensions that one finds in the left wing or the radical Reformation, the first articulation of a real demand for toleration, that you're just going to be different forever, and that one needs to abide with that. So that kind of change, and I think that distinction is one that comes back to haunt us now in ecumenism. What should it look like? Is our aim tolerance or toleration, or is our goal conquered? How would they differ? Is conquered even feasible? What then of our present age? Well, those of you who follow the Lutheran Church Press, and I do it sometimes with pleasure and sometimes out of a feeling of duty because it's not always encouraging, we are very divided about our self-understanding, and it shows itself most directly, I think, in attitudes towards ecumenism. There are those who talk about Lutheranism as an evangelical Catholic movement. I don't know whether that's a familiar term to you, or evangelical Catholic party. Catholic is always a word that makes people say, what do you mean? Are we going back to Rome? As some of my parishioners put it. And I find saying, well, if you do, you're going to have to leave me behind. I mean, so I don't think. But again, that understanding rooted much more in that vision of the Augsburg Confession in 1530. That we are a movement within the Church Catholic, and that needs to be distinguished from Roman Catholic. Catholic meaning universal. But that for us, in one, I mean, see, it's funny when you deal with the Orthodox, because then you think, well, they're all not, but for Western Christendom, for Latin Christendom, that does mean that first and one of your first and foremost dialogue partner is the Church of Rome. And that one must continue to press one's case. Now, then the issue comes up, well, what about all the others? History has produced a lot of others now. What about those who are the heirs of Calvinist tradition? In a country like the United States, for heaven's sakes, what would ecumenism mean if you weren't talking to Baptists? No. do you understand yourself as an evangelical Catholic movement? You know, do you talk, how does that work out with as many different families of the faith as we now have? It's been interesting in where I teach, because there's kind of a division about this, and you'll have somebody who'll talk about us as an evangelical Catholic movement, and not too much later, somebody will be up in the pulpit talking about these as a glorious time for the children of the Reformation. That the history has meant that our relationship to other Protestant groups, that in many ways we have a distinct tradition and a bond, and that our preeminent ecumenical direction or conversation should be with those. My advisor in graduate school was Presbyterian, and he told me once, he said, you know, one has the feeling with the Lutherans that's a little bit like, well, we'll play with you until my favorite kid in the neighborhood is allowed out. And the minute the Roman Catholics seem at all interested, you're off with them. I mean, I was very struck by that, you know. And he was one who was involved in ecumenical dialogue. So, again, it probably depended on the people he was working with. But is there some way we can balance that? How should we think of ourselves? I mean, if we're making a witness to the Church Universal, does that entail preserving a denomination? Or do we get so caught up in preserving the denomination that we confuse our wider task to the whole of the body of Christ? Lutherans are blessed and blighted by the fact that we carry very light baggage ecumenically. If you read the Augsburg Confession, it said there that what is necessary for the true unity of the Church is the proper proclamation of the gospel, understood this, that we are forgiven and made right with God wholly by the work of Christ and not by our works, and the proper administration of the sacraments. It goes on to say what does not unite us, what is not necessary, is unity in human or man-made just pulling a blank on the word, but traditions. Thank you. Okay. And so, now, what that suggests in one sense is, the traditions, we can take them or leave them, you know, if the core is there. But the other problem is that Lutheranism has a useful and tricky doctrine of what they call adiaphora in Greek, which means that there are things that are matters of indifference. Right? Traditions, they're a matter of indifference, except it's not like you can do a permanent separation, because the thing that's a matter of indifference here, the next minute, can become very critical to a true proclamation of the gospel. And I will give you, those of you who were there yesterday, I did make somewhat light of the argument that goes on in our circles about the adoption of the historic episcopate, and just saying that if you're trying to reach out to people outside of the community, when they find how much energy you're expending on that, they're a little bit like, why? Well, when there are so many other driving needs in the world, why would you do it? Well, let me say that one of the most recent problems that has come up was a proposed concordat with Episcopalians in the United States. One of the things that involved, you know, the Episcopalians do understand that they have sustained the episcopal office, the office of bishop, in historic succession. That when the Anglican Church formed, separated itself from Rome, they took their bishops with them. So they had been duly ordained in the succession, which the Church taught goes all the way back to Peter. And that the bishops, as the rightful heirs to the apostles and of Christ, are then privy to a grace of teaching and certain teachings of Christ that don't come in written form. So that this plays a very important role. And the sustaining of that succession says something about the validity of the ministry. Right? All their priests are ordained by bishops who are rightly in this succession. We don't have that. Some of that is historical accident. We didn't get to take the bishops with us except with Sweden.
Which, yeah. Really, I was on day two, and everybody kind of tried to have somebody at their ordination. They came out of the Augustine committee.
So that you can kind of swing both ways. Now, what's interesting... Yes, and the interesting is that the Swedes don't make a big deal out of it. Again, for them, it was historic. They went, the king decided, the country went. You know, they didn't, but the problem then becomes, if we are to come together in a relationship with the Episcopalians. What about the bishops? What about the way we ordain? Now, the irony of it is that there was we've already been communing with Episcopalians. As I understand this, this was an interim arrangement that we would share the Eucharist on the foundation that each side would work at these problematic things. Well, to me, of course, once you started sharing the Eucharist, you sort of give it away the store, and it's rather embarrassing to say, well, I guess we're going to back off that. I don't know that God really gives us the latitude to back off. But the problem has been that when the agreement was struck, that what it would involve, you know, will have some effect on how we're going to relate to others. Should it? Should we care? How much should we care?
Mm-hmm. I got identified myself as a spy. I'm a Presbyterian.
Uh-huh. Would you have agreed with my advisor who said that about...
No, I haven't thought about that very much.
Oh. I'd like...
My brother was very active Episcopalian. Mm-hmm. He died. I remember at the funeral, there was a great big poster that three big circles, Roman Catholic, Lutheran, and Anglican. I mean, these were the ones that... And our Presbyterian does this a little bit.
I know.
Where are we, you know, on this whole business? But we were talking about evangelical Catholic. And I think there's a very, very strong... not numerically very strong feeling about evangelical Catholicism within the Reformed tradition. Mm-hmm. I think Calvin is very much in that direction. Yeah. And I think Karl Barth in the Church Dogmatics also really is coming out there. And then the United Church of Christ, there was a Mercersburg movement.
Mm-hmm.
And the German Reformed Church was a little soft.
Right.
And
that was a very strong ecumenical bent.
Very much in that party. And I know I've been distressed. I married a Norwegian Lutheran woman, and her mother gets Lutheran magazines, and I keep reading and hearing about the static between the Lutherans and the Episcopalians now on the historic Episcopate. And it bothers me. I mean, I feel, oh, gee, why is this going to be such a hard thing? Because I wrote a paper on baptism. I used Jensen about this, mm-hmm. stuff in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And when you come out, we're in a countercultural situation. I mean, we can't take Christendom for example or for granted anymore.
Yeah.
It seems to me there is a mission imperative for ecumenism. We need to transcend these differences and realize that the language we speak and the truth that we proclaim is a foreign truth to our culture. And I think this is mixed strategies from the different thing. The luxury of our divisions is not so readily.
Well, and you know, one of the things I've wondered sometimes about being, I mean, in a Lutheran seminary is, I mean, you do have the strength of solidarity in some ways that can sort of delude you about, you know, that you're going to hold on to some point because it's so critical. Because I remember one of the really rewarding things for me in graduate school, I mean, there just aren't a whole lot of Christians out there in many ways, you know, and that when you feel that anybody that will share the faith with you, that you can talk in that way about it, was just really welcome. And so that the taking courses, I took a course called Comparative Confessions that my advisor actually taught, where we looked at the documents, and we had people representing the different traditions, and it was just wonderful. But clearly a sense of not so much what divided us, but that, you know, this was a group of people who cared enough to read this stuff, you know, like that it mattered, and who were active in congregations. And so I think you're right that it's sometimes like it's almost like myopia, you know, that you do, that we think we had certain problems in the 16th century, and they're important. I don't happen to think that this problem is a new one. I mean, I think that self-understanding of how to relate to the larger body of Christendom was there. They also sent copies of the Augsburg Confession to the Patriarch of Jerusalem, who was sort of like, what are they talking about, you know? But what happens is that because of the defining nature of that period, that sometimes, you know, we can forget, we keep rehashing those battles, and you want to say, we're not living in the same world that they were, where people were different kinds of Christian, you know? And so that it is, and that's where I think the missionary enterprise and evangelism was so important, that when they took the gospel, first time people would say, so why do I go with the Baptist missionary or the Roman missionary? Do I go, you know, why? Why are there five of you? And in some of the churches, what they did, I mean, it's the church in India that
South India.
Yeah, South India just came together as one thing and didn't let itself be defined as sharply that way. Yeah, please.
Well, I was going to ask about the Church of South India. I was there for a period of time, for just a month in short-term mission. And again, there was a conflict between the group I was with, which is more of a nominalist kind of Christian group, versus the Assyrian Church. And the group I was with kept portraying the Assyrian Church as being somewhat of an evil. And they speak in the part of either good or evil, you're either my enemy or you're with me. You know?
Yep.
And I did. They had a point to make because the Assyrian Church seemed to be amassing a lot of the wealth in individual communities. They had the finest buildings. Their priests rode the best motorcycles when nobody else had any. You know, that sort of thing. And so, if we're talking about ecumenicism involving a possible evil, is that a good thing?
Well, and if it's in that case, you know, I mean, this, the other thing about, I was talking about tolerance or whatever in Concord, I mean, a forced, see, I think anything that's going to end up with the position that Luther was in, is doing enforced silence, because it's better to shut up than to break the bond of charity. The root experience of our movement is no. So that's why I think we bring an important thing to ecumenism in just that, that, I mean, this is the people say, it's so easy to smooth the edges and, you know, and make it sound alike. And I personally am not there. But what I know is that it would be a lot easier to go that way if you just stay onto your own. And I think that's a luxury we can't have anymore. You know, another place where this is really coming up is that the last meeting of the Orthodox Dialogue was in Moscow, and I was there in June. And this was the first time I'd seen these people since all those, we meet every 2 years, since all those dramatic changes in the East. So the people from Romania, whatever, are talking. And what's sort of pouring in now in terms of the vacuum? That's, I mean, the restrictions have lightened up. But their feeling, too, of being sort of threatened by, you know, is it going to be different Christian groups working together, or fundamentalist groups from the United States have been quick in, you know, and then other competing things, anthroposophy and whatever, and the gentleman who was representing the Lutheran Church in Romania said to us, it's been 40 years, really, he said, that these people have, by and large, lived in a spiritual wasteland. And he said they just don't have anything to go on to make judgments. But they're also sort of struck by this Heinz 57 variety, and does it make the gospel very credible? You know, so that was striking to me. And the tensions, of course, are ripe. The Orthodox are quite upset in the Eastern Bloc countries now because of the present popes. I gather sort of, you know, new bishops and off we go, and feeling like, wait a minute, you know.
You mentioned Romania. I'm getting the message that there's a lot of feeling of compromise on part of the hierarchy.
I suppose this is a terrible thing to put on the tape, but, sort of condemn, but I gather that one of the problems indeed is that the Orthodox Church in Romania has, under at least parts of the hierarchy, undermined its credibility very seriously because of, well, you know, I mean, there's a terrible one. What price do you pay to be allowed to survive? But that some of them have been implicated in ways that they've, in fact, I think some have been pushed out of their positions because they felt they were. But that also, I mean, just overall leaves a bad taste in the mouths of many people for the church.
I'm sorry, compromising?
Oh, that I guess that they were, they went along with, knew a great deal more about the Ceausescu regime and sort of benefited from his largesse by going along to get along. Now, clearly that wasn't true of everyone. But that at the highest levels there appear, at least there is that suspicion among the people. And the other thing I found at the last conference of the Lutheran World Federation, it was one of the first times we had Lutherans. First time we had Lutherans from the Ukraine, you know, or a lot of, but talking to a lot of the Lutherans from Eastern Europe, ecumenism has also been somewhat of a development and a luxury, it would appear, more amongst Western Europeans. At least I talked to a bishop in Poland, Lutherans from Hungary, and I suppose some of it is the pressures they were under, but the preservation, I mean, they were confessional in the sense of just jot and tittle in many ways of the Augsburg Confession and such, and their statements about the majority, in one case, of Roman Catholics or be it Orthodox, were, there was a great deal of opposition and tension. So as we come to meet, it's going to be, that mix is going to be sort of interesting, how that will influence us and what history they have here. Because, I mean, they obviously experienced some things at the hand of a majority that have left them very, very bitter. So.
You mentioned an ecumenical movement towards Muslims and Hindus. And is that a very prevalent thing?
I don't know whether one wants to call, I mean, I don't know whether ecumenical is the right term for, again, part of the difficulty in these is what goal do you set? You know, what is it you think you can accomplish? I do know how prevalent it is. I mean, there are dialogues going on. There was actually one with Marxism, too. But that, and I'm sure that in areas of the world where these people live to next to one another, obviously not always in good relationship, there's much more of a drive, I mean, to come to some understanding.
There seems to be a bit, you know, do we have a good product to sell or not? And
there seems to be debaters in Eastern Christian cases, as pluralism, between the group that wants to maintain the uniqueness of Christ, but affirm the contributions of other major faiths, and others that begin to see a commonality of revelation and spirituality between the faiths. And I want to go much more kind of synergistic way, which is a loaded word.
Yeah.
And that's a very interesting debate, I think.
I think it is. Let me say that at one level, I think that it just serves some purposes, is that very often we labor under misapprehensions of each other. That in some instances, for example, you would hear a Christian give account of Muslim beliefs or a Muslim of Christian beliefs, and just the dialogue could start right there to say, wait a minute, that isn't true. And it seems to me that concern, because some of the animosity and misunderstanding can, well, probably some of you know that just even in times when relationships between Lutherans and Roman Catholics or any Protestant Roman Catholics were terrible, you had all sorts of bizarre ideas that didn't necessarily accord with the truth. But I think the question you're raising is a very important one. Whether one sees this as an opportunity indeed to witness to one's faith, which doesn't mean denigrating the other. Carl Broughton, you know, he's still on the faculty of the School of Theology in Chicago, the Lutheran School of Theology, and I think he's sort of retiring out, settling in Northfield. I'm not quite sure. He and Jensen, I think, are starting some kind of institute up there. But his work just recently, his articles and writings, have been very much on the finality of Christ, precisely sensing this threat. The issue, I guess, comes is that, you know, that way we have contact in the world with so many people we didn't before, that somehow or other what witness we give and what self-understanding we have needs to be very self-consciously that in a world where there are a lot of people who don't believe the way we do. And it's a lot, for example, you know, with Luther, he had a letter from somebody who was on the Eastern Front of the Empire and actually knew Muslims there. And he said, you know, these are very moral people, very good people. Are you sure they're going to hell? I mean, there's no hope for them. And Luther's sort of response to that was, you know, they're as sneaky as a lot of other people, because it's their, one looks at their virtues and sort of thinks these are good people. We're not saved by our virtues, you know, but they deny and defame the name of Christ. And there's, well, see, it's easier to do that. It was easier for him because he didn't have the neighbor. And I think that what's happening now is even in this country, you know, I mean, suddenly I look around, even Minneapolis, St. Paul, and there are a lot of Muslims. And that somehow or other, to make sense of of who we are. I mean, and even as we teach students, that they need to know something about that. It's for me, it's scary. It's a place where I feel on my least sure footing.
I'm from Calgary, and we have a parasite tea community. Mm-hmm. And one of the issues that has been in the press and in the schools last year has been around Catan, which is, if you don't know, it's a ceremonial dagger that once you're baptized feet, you have to keep on your person all the time.
Oh.
Okay? There's been issues.
Yeah, I'm
going
to this country if you know issues.
In the schools.
Oh my, yeah.
Okay, now for baptized feet not to have them is not on their faith. For other people who have children in the school, you know that some children there
are armed.
Might have a dagger on their person if it's extremely threatening.
Yeah.
Now this has been going on for about a year and a half. One of the interesting dynamics I think of it is the people who want to just get the kirpans out of there and let's not talk about this anymore, are the people who have no religious background.
Uh-huh.
The people who have a faith background, be that Christian or Sikh or Muslim or Jewish, say, hold on, let's see what this is about and how it's dealt with and how maybe we can come to a compromise or some kind of other, because they see things as a matter of faith as mattering, whereas the others, it's only a case of safety. And they get really offended that religion, even in this form of a kirpan, should answer the
school. Well, you know, that same issue came up in England. Do you remember those young women students who wanted to wear the headdress, cover their head, and that was, they did not want to allow that in the schools. And were, and part of it, of course, is that there are aspects of that. I don't know enough to say if there's a way of understanding that doesn't seem detrimental to women. But that part of it was it went against, and I think this is the other thing about a community's values, which, whether they're straightforwardly Christian, I mean, they are values endowed with sort of, so to say, well, if we tolerate that, just like you're saying, we tolerate something, does it compromise what we're saying is defining of us as Christians? You can understand these people as we sort of look at our society as civilized or whatever, or what its freedoms and respects are, to let that happen begins to erode values we hold dear. And what's striking is that in almost all the at least nominally Christian countries of the world, see, that mean even like when you read about the merger of the two Germanies, I mean, a number of Gastarbeiter they have there who are not, that almost every Christian community now just has to look at this in a way. And I'll tell you, see, that I think Westerners, and I don't mean this badly, but what we would do is try to have dialogue. One thing that struck me when I was at the Lutheran World Federation Assembly, that there were a number of Lutherans from Africa, and as well from India, but particularly several of the Africans who were speaking, they came from countries with numerically much greater Muslim majorities, and they were frightened.
Yeah.
And one of them stood up and talked about how little by little their civil rights were being whittled back, they were not holding any government posts, their children were not getting access to schools. And finally, at one point, he said, "We tell you about this, and your solution is to talk about dialogue." And he said, "In our situation, that makes no sense. It's not possible. You don't have dialogue if somebody doesn't want to talk to you." And what you've pointed out is that, in I think rightly so, is that in many cases, see, there are others in religious communities who say, if you're willing to dialogue, you must not really be very sure about what you believe or think it's right. I had a classmate in graduate school who went to, studied Sri Lankan Buddhism. He was a Methodist. And he said, when he was there, he said, "They want to dialogue all the time. They know I'm wrong. I mean, that's, they're glad to talk to me." And he said, "But the more you sort of, they're just like, well, you must not really be sure of what you think if you're going to do." So that's the other side about trying to understand the cultural perceptions of dialogue for these people. It may not be what it is for us. So anyway, it's eating time. I'm sorry, I guess. Thank you.